Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Wednesday, May 19th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Noelle Swan.
And I'm Dave Scott.
Mavis Rudolph was just 13 when she realized what she wanted to do with her life. It was June 11th, 2019, and she watched from the courtroom gallery as her public defender father argued for the freedom of Durrell Jones, a Black man who had been convicted of murder by an all-white jury in 1986. When the jury, this time with two Black jurors, came back with a not guilty verdict, she knew. I got into the car with my dad after the verdict and was like, "This is the work I need to do," she recalls. I met Mavis when she was a student in my preschool classroom. When I caught up with her a year ago, cell phone footage of George Floyd's death had just emerged, and Mavis could no longer wait to add her voice to calls for racial justice. She joined protests and solidified her resolve to obstruct the injustice that we are living in right now, as she told me at the time. A year later, former police officer Derek Chauvin has been convicted of Mr. Floyd's murder. In Mavis's view, tremendous change is still needed. "Our first police officers were slave patrols," she says. "That says a lot about how our systems have been built." At a societal level, she says the verdict opened a window of possibility for changes. It showed that convictions can happen. These hopes have been buoyed by the public discussions of justice, privilege, and racial equity over the past year. "White people need to be forced to think about these issues," she argues. "Black people live it every day." Her advice to white people wanting to better understand these issues? Listen to people of color and learn. If race is hard to talk about, then you are probably having the right kind of conversations. Now, today's stories. Our first story. A neighborhood in Minneapolis, heavily damaged during protests a year ago, is trying to rebuild in a way that embodies ideals of diversity and equality, potentially offering a new model for urban redevelopment.
When unrest in Minneapolis spread to the city's Longfellow neighborhood last year, Ruel Islam opened his restaurant, Gandhi Mahal, for medics to treat injured protesters. The next night, rioters set fire to the police building and dozens of businesses in Longfellow. And by dawn, his restaurant lay in ashes. In a Facebook post that went viral the same morning, his teenage daughter, Hafsa, quoted him as saying, "Let my building burn. Justice needs to be served. Put those officers in jail." His words resonate a year later as more than an expression of forgiveness. Mr. Islam has helped form a neighborhood collective called Longfellow Rising that intends to rebuild the triangular three-block zone that included Gandhi Mahal to further elevate and celebrate the neighborhood's racial, ethnic, and cultural diversity. The discussions that gave shape to Longfellow Rising yielded a governing principle: that people of color would form the heart of the initiative and guide its progress. "I'm not interested in going back to normal," says Meena Natarajan, artistic and executive director of Panji World Theater and a member of the collective's board. "I think we can build a better community, a better city." This story was reported by Martin Kuz in Minneapolis for The Monitor.
It has been over 20 years since the U.S. was last involved in a serious effort to resolve the Palestinian issue. The current fighting between Israel and Hamas might, just possibly, prompt Washington to try again.
At the heart of the current fighting between Israel and Hamas lies a paradox. On the one hand, the fighting has shaken a widespread belief in Israel that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was fading away. It has put the idea of a two-state solution back on the table. On the other hand, both Hamas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are implacably opposed to any such negotiated compromise. Both, at least for now, stand to emerge politically strengthened from this latest bloodletting. But in the longer term, the outbreak of violence might, just might, prompt a renewed focus on trying to find a long-term compromise between Israel and the Palestinians. That would demand an active role of America, Israel's closest ally. President Joe Biden has shown no interest in expending political capital on what has historically proven to be a fruitless task. His foreign policy priority is China, not the Middle East. He will doubtless be profoundly dubious about launching a new U.S. diplomatic initiative there. Still, the current fighting has raised another question at the heart of the Gaza paradox: whether the price of not doing so might be too high. You can read Ned Temko's full column in today's issue.
With interest in hybrid homeschooling on the rise, many parents are emphasizing a new priority for their children's education: flexibility.
Lines between school and home have blurred during the pandemic, including families overseeing remote public schooling or shifting to homeschooling or learning pods. Now, parents are making decisions about the next school year, a task complicated by questions about remaining safety precautions come fall and, for some, the timeline for vaccines for children under 12. Parents experimenting with education options that meld learning both inside and outside the home will likely continue, observers say, as families prioritize flexibility and safety. One option more people are considering: hybrid homeschooling, where students are taught at home and attend a school in person several days a week. "We went back and forth about whether to go back to public school next year," says Amanda Hawley, a Massachusetts mother of two girls. She decided to stick with hybrid homeschooling based on the positive experience her daughters had. Not all families can afford homeschooling materials or the tuition that some hybrid homeschool arrangements require. And the approach can chip away at the sense of community that schools try to build, says Robert Kunzman, a professor at Indiana University. Still, he notes, the whole notion of what counts as homeschooling is continuing to evolve. This story was reported by Chelsea Sheasley in Needham, Massachusetts, for The Monitor.
French society is increasingly diverse, and its publishing industry is having to stretch itself to reflect this diversity in new titles and a broader literary conversation.
France's book industry puts out around 200 new titles a day. It has thousands of publishers vying for authors and readers. But the face of French literature has long been that of a white, male writer. Only 12 women writers have won the prestigious Prix Goncourt in its 118-year history. Now a deluge of new writing is hitting the bookshelves, with titles by both established publishers and niche publishers trying to open up the field. Over the last decade, this has led to a shift in the publishing world toward greater diversity, including more titles by second-generation French authors and other writers of color. Writing workshops are increasingly popular in France, as are graduate degrees in creative writing. The pandemic may have accelerated this shift, as more people found time to write during the lockdowns. The result is tumult and opportunity in an industry steeped in tradition that is trying to find new ways to represent the reality of its diverse society. Anne-Sophie Stefanini, the literary director at JC Latte, says, there's really a strong intention to be the most open, the most curious. French publishing houses, big or small, are thinking about diversity right now. It's a concern for all literary editors of this generation. This story was reported by Colette Davidson in Paris for The Monitor.
In this week's Progress Roundup, careful planning for the needs of people and the natural world benefits all. One study says that armed conflicts are rare in places where natural resources are well managed. You can find the full roundup of Points of Progress by Lindsay McGinnis in today's issue. Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on why so many Colombians are protesting so long. Anti-government protests in Colombia have now entered their fourth week, which is unusual enough for one of Latin America's stronger democracies. The numbers are also atypically big, with tens of thousands on the streets at a time in most cities. Another notable is the range of voices, from urban youth to rural poor. And the number of their complaints spans from corruption to police brutality to a proposed tax hike that first triggered the protests. Most remarkable, however, may be a popular demand for the new style of politics. What seems to be ruled out is the continuity of the politics of hatred and polarization that have characterized Colombia in the past several years, writes Mauricio Cárdenas, a former finance minister in America's Quarterly. Governing from one side of the political spectrum is a recipe for disaster. Now, protester Miguel Morales told BBC, "We need to make good choices in next year's election." By the size and duration of the protests, the choice seems to have been made. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for joining us today. Come back tomorrow when Chief Culture Writer Stephen Humphreys interviews an author who believes no conflict is unsolvable for the next installment of the Respect Project. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how turning to God, divine love, for inspiration and guidance brings greater wisdom, peace, and joy to parenting efforts. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Erica Page.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.